Blog Talk Radio.
Thompson and Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. We are back after our snafu last weekend because we had a repeat show all ready to play and it didn't play for whatever reason, and it's just the techie gremlins that get in the machine sometimes. So thank you, my dear friend Crystalyn is here with me. Thank you, Crystalyn, for trying to get that show on. I'm sorry it didn't work out, but we'll never be gone for long. We will always be back to share spirituality and truth and beauty and goodness with all of you, and we thank you for listening. And hi, Crystalyn, by the way.
Hi, Paula.
There you are.
Good morning.
It is my dear friend. It is my friend and co-host, Crystalyn B. Clarkson. Today we have a great guest, and this is our series on the personal religious experience that we've been doing, and we've tried to have a variety of folks on that would give us a taste of their own personal religious experience. And of course, this show is primarily based on the teachings of the Urantia book, and the Urantia book holds up a personal religious experience as the epitome of experiences and in fact God consciousness. When you start to become aware of God and the presence of God within you, and the fact that God leads you into all truth and the spirit of truth leads you into all truth, and you can have a personal religious experience, and it is your journey to find God, and it's not characterized by anybody else's journey. It's unique to you, it's precious, it's invaluable. And it's a relationship that you have with the infinite creator of all that is. So we have today for you a man by the name of Roger Wayne Woolsey. Roger's a minister, an ordained minister, and he's had quite a career. He's been on quite a religious journey himself. He's an ordained pastor in the United Methodist Church. He teaches religious classes as adjunct instructor at the Graceland University in Iowa. He has served as a pastor for churches in Minnesota, Iowa, and Colorado. He's currently serving the Wesley Foundation campus in ministry on the University of Boulder. And he's just written a great book, Kissing Fish. Did I get that right, Roger?
Yes.
Yes, yeah, Christianity for people who don't like Christianity.
Christianity for people who don't like Christianity. And, you know, I just love the way you care. And we all know you said you interviewed people on the Boulder Mall, and you found out that lots of people say that they are spiritual but not religious. And so I think, you know, we characterize progressive Christianity is really going in that direction. And I believe that Christianity is emerging from a past, let's just say, way of being into a future way of being, a new way of being, maybe being more like Jesus himself than they are being about Jesus. And it's thrilling to me because I would characterize myself as a Jesusonian, somebody who wants to emulate the religious life of Jesus rather than practice a religion about him. But I love him dearly, and I know you do too. So tell us a little bit about your journey and what you're doing right now.
Well, we'll go to the very beginning. My parents met at the University of Kansas, KU Lawrence, through the United Methodist Campus Ministry there called the Wesley Foundation. And I was born in 1968, which was the year the United Methodist Church actually merged and became the United Methodist Church, and was raised in that tradition in a rather low-key kind of way. Went to church most Sundays, vacation Bible school in the summers, taught to say nightly prayers at bedtime as a kid, maybe table grace we would do as a family at dinner time. But really not a whole lot of talking about God and church really in the home. It was more an environment to allow us to come to our own perspectives and not feel like anything was being forced on us, which a lot of people do have the opposite kind of upbringing. And ours was very graceful and loosely held and not really forced upon. So I never really felt a huge need to rebel. Although I did have times of rebellion, I was confirmed at the age of 13 or 14 or so, and really enjoyed the confirmation classes. But the Sunday after I was confirmed, I sort of in my mind became an atheist because I sensed a lot of hypocrisy and disconnect between all these nice people dressed in fancy nice clothes and really the hard work of loving broken people out in the streets and in the world. And I saw a lot of show and not a lot of action. And I maybe from a bit of an immature perspective, got disgruntled with the church for quite a while and gradually eased back into it due to a variety of things, including some rather mystical experiences starting my freshman year of college. And that reminded me that there really is a God and a source of all that is, and that source loves me, and I am able to love it. And I sort of had an original creed that I created for myself, that I choose to be in connection. And within that, I choose to be a monotheist. And within that, I choose Christianity. And within that, I choose a Wesleyan Methodist perspective, and all of that sort of held loosely, but it was a working way for a while. I experienced some other traditions during college and eventually found myself in a very small, intimate campus ministry at McAllister College called Compline, where we would sit around a bunch of students in a circle on Wednesday evenings at 10 o'clock, and we would sing some songs and take turns presenting a little bit of a message or a reflection, and then have some time of prayer and go downstairs and have apple cider and cookies. And I began to shift from sort of thinking I could be a solo Christian to really valuing the need to do it in a group, in a community setting, that it's a shared journey and I can only go so far on my own. 2 years after college, I had a profound experience where I did feel a sense of being called by God into ministry. It wasn't a voice saying, go, Roger, be a United Methodist pastor, but it was very much a celebration of my realization of God in my life and my gifts and graces from God. But there was this challenge to use them. And in all these different settings at the time of mediation and conflict resolution and crisis counseling, I was doing everything but bringing God into it. And there was this invitation to actually go ahead and share faith and get people to share about their faith and where they're at. And I shared the experience with my church, and they invited me to consider it as a call experience. And I found myself attending the Iliff School of Theology in Denver, which was a great experience for me. 4 years of just great fun and thriving and academically, intellectually, spiritually, all kinds of field education experiences in prisons around Colorado and in churches and in different settings. More and more, it really felt like this was the journey and path for me to pursue. So I became an ordained United Methodist pastor and have been so for, I guess, about 16 years now, maybe 17. And the last 4 years, or actually, take that back, the last 7 years, I've been doing campus ministry at the Wesley Foundation at CU Boulder, and in the last 4 years, I've taken on a new role of also being a writer and an active blogger, and of course, my book, Kissing Fish, came out last year, and I've had more and more opportunities to do speaking around the country, and basically, I'm an advocate for progressive Christianity, and feel, like you do, that the church is indeed in a time of reformation, and that's progressive Christianity is a piece of that reformation that's happening right now.
And beautiful. how do you describe, when someone asks, what are your concepts of progressive Christianity?
Well, I have a rather wordy academic kind of definition in the book, but I won't read that. I'll share this. It's a focus more on the religion of Jesus than the religion about Jesus. And so it takes very seriously his way, his teachings, his example. And so it puts an emphasis, and I'll use some fancy words here, the emphasis is on orthopraxy, right practice, and less upon orthodoxy, right belief or right doctrine.
So I love that.
Not that it diminishes particular beliefs or teachings, excludes them, but we'd rather err on the side of right practice, and so the emphasis is more on right practice and example and teaching than on specific doctrines and dogmas. And then a few more things to share. Progressive Christianity tends to emphasize the key teachings of love, loving our neighbor, compassion, grace, forgiveness, mercy, justice, inclusion, hospitality, loving kindness. And we would, in fact, say that since those teachings and values are core and essential, some of us might even say that progressive Christianity more rightly ought to be called conservative Christianity, because it's conserving those original core values and teachings that made Christianity a beautiful gift to the world in the first place. And what's become known as conservative Christianity is actually sort of a newfangled thing that isn't really conserving what we think we ought to be conserved. And a little bit more to share, that salvation in progressive Christianity is understood to be a bit more about what happens here in this worldly realm, here and now, and a little less about what happens in the next state after we die. And it's a little bit more emphasis on the collective, corporate, social, societal aspect of salvation, and not just the personal, individual notion, which is a very Americanized kind of perspective. And so evangelical Christianity is, it's a very American invention. And in some respects, progressive Christianity is reclaiming the Jewish perspective on salvation, that it's a group experience and not just an individual one. So those are some pieces to share, and maybe that we take the Bible seriously, but not necessarily literally. So those are some things to share to get the ball rolling, I guess.
Well, hooray!
Well,
I mean,
that's very similar to the type of Christianity I was raised in, you know. So I can I resonate with that, and I was surprised, I think, when I moved to the United States and found that what was passing for Christianity publicly or nationally, what everyone thought of as Christianity, was so different from what my experience had been growing up overseas.
Yes.
You know,
yeah,
it was,
you know,
very much a similar experience to yours. Go ahead,
Paul.
I say hooray for, you know, this idea, this very concept of not taking the Bible too literally. Because, and I think in one of your interviews you said, you know, they live to the letter of the law, but they miss its spirit. And your comment about orthodoxy, that, you know, the written, yeah, I mean, obviously any of us can read the same written word and interpret it completely different and get something different out of it. So, you know, we can't be uniform in that way. Our individual perspectives are so unique. But if we can get to the place where we're tolerant of other people's understanding of God and other people's journey to God, whatever that is, and not only tolerate it but actually learn to love it, celebrate it with relish, cherish every aspect of their experience of God and validate their experience of God rather than try to invalidate it because it isn't our experience or it isn't what our group prescribes to or what we prescribe to, or, you know, which obviously causes the sectarian rivalries and the house divided.
Yeah.
So, go ahead, Roger.
What you're sharing right now reminds me of another piece that I should have mentioned about progressive Christianity, is that it is non-exclusive. So,
right.
Whereas fundamentalism might say that Christianity is the one right, true, only way to connect to God and to be saved, progressive Christianity would say that, I can't speak for all progressive Christians, but we might say something like, yes, Jesus is the life, the true, and the life, the truth, and the way. But anybody, no matter what they call themselves or how they identify, if they are living a life pursuing justice, if they're living a life that seeks forgiveness and reconciliation and restoration of estrangement, if they're seeking to live in compassion and grace and forgiveness, well, then they, in fact, are on that way, that truth, and that life. And so
they're following that inner guidance.
Yeah, and so there's no agenda to make sure someone becomes a Christian. If they're living in that way, well, praise God. Let them be the best Rastafarian or Jew or Muslim or Buddhist or whatever path that they're on, be the best one of those that they can be, and we would celebrate that and not feel a need to have them convert to our way. In fact, we can learn a lot from them too.
Right. And Jesus himself said,
I always
said,
wonder,
you know,
why. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, Jesus himself said we would know each other by our fruits, not by what book we read or what religion we profess or what doctrines we hold, or, you know, not by anything like that, but what church we go to,
et cetera. I used to wonder why. What was Jesus' purpose in sharing the parable of the Good Samaritan? If Jesus' idea of the pathway to God being exclusive, or if his teaching was that there was only one right way, then why did he share that parable? That parable which so clearly indicated that someone who was from a culture that was on the outs in
mm-hmm.
in that region
mm-hmm.
could be considered more godly.
Yeah.
There you go.
I think if he were to tell that parable today, it wouldn't surprise me if he might use something instead of a Samaritan in the U.S. context. He might say, oh, hypothetically, a gay, HIV-infected, Hispanic illegal immigrant.
or a Muslim.
or a Muslim, right.
Yeah.
So something that we tend to have a hard time fathoming God could be at work in such a person, and yet in that instance, they are in fact the neighbor. They are the one on the right path, yeah.
Right. And so the job, I think the task, and I've kind of been on the periphery of Christianity. My parents quit going to church when I was 8 years old. But I was still deeply spiritual all my life, I was. And I've had a real experience of God and Jesus. And I have felt them in my life, all my life. And I just didn't have a real experience of the church. And in fact, it felt like at times the church rejected me. So, you know, it's amazing that you can make this distinction between your religious life and your inner understanding of God and the external outworkings of that with the church or whatever. But it seems to me, and I've always been kind of rooting for the church to find itself and to find the true meaning, its purpose, and which is its love for Jesus, its faith. You know, it's tremendous faith and not its dogma or its doctrine, but something beyond that. And I see Christianity progressing very well along those lines, and I applaud it. But one of the challenges, I think, and I'm sure you'd agree, is it has a black eye now. I mean, it's gotten involved with politics, which probably never should have happened. That was a mistake. And you know, some people have come out against science. Well, gee, if we believe that God is omnipotent, omnipresent, omniscient, omniscient, I mean, he is the God of science. Science is not apart from God. God is the God of all things. And so, you know,
yeah.
If we're thinking holistically, we understand that perhaps evolution is God's technique, not something apart from God. Of course, we all evolve. We see evolution taking place in front of our very eyes. I like to tell people my grandmother crossed the prairie in a covered wagon and lived to see man walk on the moon. If that's not evolution and progress, I don't know what is. Go ahead.
Well, what you're sharing hints at exactly why I titled the book as I did, Kissing
right.
Fish. There's sort of two... double entendre, two meanings with the name. The cover on the book has a picture of my old car that had the Jesus Christian fish emblem that you see on the back of some bumpers and the Darwin evolution fish emblem. But instead of attacking each other or eating each other like you sometimes see, I had them face-to-face kissing each other to try to simply convey to folks that, hey, these two perspectives are not mutually exclusive or incompatible, and
exactly.
Christians can in fact believe in contemporary science and evolution. But then the other meaning is, as an early image of symbol of Christianity was the fish, not just the cross, but even before the cross was a symbol, was the fish. And to the extent that Christianity is symbolized by the fish, and to the extent that a fish is an animal that not many people would want to kiss, inviting someone to reconsider Christianity, to consider it anew, is a little bit like inviting them to kiss a fish, which is a little bit off-putting, and there's a wariness about it. And
mm-hmm.
the Barna Research Institute, which is like the Christian version of the Gallup poll, they're an evangelical group, but they do rigorous scientific statistical work. A few years back, they studied young adults, I believe 18 to 25, and when they heard the word Christianity, their associations the top three associations were anti-gay, exclusive, and judgmental.
Mm. Oh, my gosh.
The rest of that list weren't any better. If those are young people in America's understandings and associations of Christianity, well, why would they want to be a part of such an organization or a religion? And yet, those understandings are based upon a rather limited understanding and awareness of a narrow scope of what Christianity is. They know about televangelists. They know about the role that they're doing in politics. They know about the hypocrisy that they hear and read in the newspaper, scandals. They hear all kinds of fire and brimstone stuff. And they're missing out, unfortunately, on another quieter but still very present aspect of Christianity, which is arguably found in a lot of mainline Protestant churches, UCC, ELCA Lutheran, American Baptist, and PCUSA Presbyterian, and United Methodist, and Quaker traditions that are much more contemplative and gentle and justice and compassion-oriented perspective on the faith. But they aren't
and service,
making
service
the headlines.
And service-oriented, too.
Right, service-oriented, and yeah.
And
making a difference.
They're Christ-like. They're making an effort to be like Christ, you know, rather than, you know. So that's beautiful. You're right. I've noticed that, too. All of those churches you mentioned, United Church of Christ. Did you mention UCC?
Yeah.
Inclusive, accepting, loving, tolerant. All of the things you list as Jesus. You know, you listed the qualities of Jesus and there's a move in that direction, and it's thrilling, and I'm so glad that you've written this book to help people understand that there is another face to Christianity, not just what they see in the media. The media, you know, obviously there's billions of human beings doing wonderful work quietly, stalwartly, and they never make it on the news, you know. And Christianity has been maligned, oftentimes unfairly.
It is, unfortunately, almost to the point, some would say it is to the point, where the word Christian itself has become damaged goods and is not redeemable. It's just too far gone in being associated with conservative evangelical fundamentalism. And I'm not willing to concede that. I'm wanting to get in the fight and reclaim the word and help people feel confident and bold to say, I am a Christian. You aren't the only way of being Christian. I am a Christian, and here I am.
There you go.
But some people aren't going to maybe use that word, and they'll identify as, well, I'm a follower of Jesus, or I'm a follower of Jesus' way, or something like that. And that they're kindred spirits, and I don't have a need for someone to say they're a Christian. But I still feel enough stubborn calling to try to reclaim the word and not allow it to be monopolized and hijacked.
Wow, that's great. Well, we have to do that, and the only way that we'll be able to, alleviate some of the misconceptions is by being who we are and standing up for, you know, another way. And you know, it's like Gandhi saying, "No, I love your Jesus. It's Christianity I have a problem with, you know." But you could say Jesus wasn't a Christian, but neither was Muhammad a Muslim, and neither was Buddha a Buddhist. You know, they lived an authentic religious life, and that's what we all trying to do ourselves is live an authentic religious life, no matter
One of the questions that I had for you, Roger, you mentioned that, that the purpose of this series is to talk about our personal spiritual experience from different faith traditions. And, you know, one of the things that we find when we hear people sharing their personal spiritual experience or their personal religious experience, either way, that we find common ground in our epiphany or in our experience with God. And so I don't know if you mind sharing. I'm hoping you will. You said that you had sort of an epiphany of sorts or a calling. You had something happen that made you feel called to become a minister. And since Paula and I are both also ordained ministers, we'd love to hear you share something about what that was like for you.
Sure. So going back to 2 years after college, this would be about 1992, I had studied philosophy and political science and was considering pursuing a career in law or even being a politician. And I had shifted away from politics because of an internship I did in D.C., and got involved in mediation and conflict resolution, empowering people to resolve their own differences and what have you, and did a fair bit of crisis intervention work on one of those 24-hour crisis hotlines. And that's the context for this call, and it was also the spring of 92 was the first year that I took the Christian season of Lent, those 40 days of preparation before Easter. I took them seriously and mindfully for the first time. So I was doing daily devotions and what have you before work. I was also sharing a house with several other housemates of all different stripes and persuasions and great diversity of humanity over those couple of years. And that was a part of my formative experience and context for this as well. So with all of that said, early April in 92, I was renting the upper floor of a house, and I had that upper floor to myself, and I was laying on my bed. It was a mattress just on the floor. I didn't have the full bed at that point, and for some reason, I just wasn't sleeping that night, which was very unusual for me because I was living life fully and vigorously and working hard and playing hard and sleeping well. But that night I wasn't sleeping, and about 2 in the morning or so, I felt a presence in the room, like you just know there's someone there. And then the presence drew closer, and I felt myself being held by this presence, and maybe even slightly gripped. I was a little resistant, and it kind of wigged me out. And immediately I was thinking, well, did I have bad pizza earlier tonight? What's going on here? You know, and I felt uncomfortable. So I actually left the room, and I went and laid on the floor next door where I had some aquariums laying around, and I'm laying on the floor there. And again, I felt this presence, and I felt myself held again. But then I decided to not resist, and it went from feeling gripped to more of a simply being sort of cradled kind of a sensation. And I surrendered into it. And then I heard a voice. And now, whether there was a tape recorder in the room that would have heard this voice or not, but I heard a voice somehow. And neither male nor female, but somehow familiar, the voice simply said, "Do you know who I am?" And without having to open my mouth, I said, "You are God." And the voice celebrated that I was at a place in life where I was realizing that certain skills that I had developed, such as crisis counseling and mediation and interacting with people from different walks of life pretty readily and easily and such, that they were not skills that I could take pride in or pat myself on the back for, but they were in fact gifts from God, and God was celebrating my awareness of that. And then there was this shift to a challenge, an invitation, that in all these different settings, I'm doing everything but bringing God into it. And so go forth and boldly do whatever it takes to share about me and to hear others share about me and to bring me into this. Now, in those settings, they were all secular settings, you know, the Hennepin County Bar Association, the Ramsey County Conciliation Courts, the crisis connection policies, all of those settings would not allow any of the counselors and mediators to talk about God and faith on their own. So I realized that I have to make a shift somehow, and what form can I do this? And I talked to the folks at my home church, and they encouraged me to interpret it as a call experience. And it felt in my gut right that that's what may be going on. So I checked out United Methodist seminaries around the country, and ILF at that time was one of the few seminaries offering courses in conflict resolution from a Christian perspective, which sort of sold me on checking out ILF. And I visited ILF and fell in love with Colorado and that school at first sight, really, and had all kinds of confirmations of that call along the way, not because of the grades in seminary, but more in various interactions that I had with people in churches or prisons or hospitals, where people somehow conveyed to me that they were sensing God's presence speaking through me from different times and occasions. And enough of those happened where, okay, this must be the path that I should continue on. And not every day has been a great day. Sometimes I have felt like throwing in the towel. Those days are fewer than they used to be, although I'm a little disgruntled with my own denomination right now. They just had their general conference completed. Every 4 years they convene, and yesterday they voted to maintain their currently wrong-headed perspective on homosexuality. And I'm one of the dissenting pastors who chooses to operate a church as if it were already a gay-friendly denomination. So Wesley Chapel, where I work, is a reconciling ministry, very gay-friendly and welcoming. And if asked, I will do a gay wedding. So there's a little bit of tension that I have, but I feel that I am better able to change the denomination I'm a part of and that I love so much within than if I were to leave. So I stick in, and I'm in here till the change happens. It's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. And so,
Hard to have your voice heard when you take your ball and go home.
Right.
Well, right. And kudos to you. My hat's off to you, because I know it takes a lot of courage. And you know, there's still those old entrenched ways of believing and you know, tradition bound ideas that, you know, go back to teachings in the Bible that, you know, people think justify this idea that homosexuality, or that any human being, is, you know, is less than any other human being. And yet, you know,
right.
It also says that God is no respecter of persons. So and that he's willing that none should perish, and that he loves us all. And so, you know, we have to stand up for those values, because they just get forgotten so much of the time, and it takes a lot of courage to do that in the face of, you know, those people who think you're just dead wrong. You know, words like heresy come to mind, or, you know. But I think the only way we'll change it is by standing our ground and saying, no, this, you know, This is the truth that I'm called to. This is what I understand.
Yeah. And ultimately, I have great faith in sort of the Wesleyan understanding, where you value scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. And to the extent that fellow Methodists can grapple and can deal in those matters, I have to believe that eventually we will all come around to being a gay-friendly denomination officially. It's just a matter of actually running and taking those four components seriously and thoroughly enough. Yes, I guess it takes courage or bravery in a way, but at the same time, I don't feel brave or heroic. I just feel like I can do no other. If our denomination rightfully errs on the side of grace when it comes to matters of divorce for reasons other than adultery and for remarriage of divorced persons, but if we're going to be graceful in those regards, which affect the majority straight population, we need to be consistent. And it's hypocritical and scapegoating if we don't allow for grace when it comes to the 5 to 8% of the population who happen to be gay or lesbian. So it's,
right.
Well,
it's a matter of...
It's surprising, too, to me that they made that decision because they've been so sort of welcoming to that population in the past 10 years or so in terms of their fellowshipping.
Yeah,
so,
well, where this comes down, ultimately, and this is a strange thing, we celebrate the fact that the denomination is growing, and a lot of that growth right now is in Africa. So therefore, more and more of the delegates are from Africa, and the delegates there tend to have a more conservative view on those sexual matters. And so the vote was very close, and if it hadn't been for those delegates, I don't want to just focus on just them, but it is in fact sort of the case that if it hadn't been just the U.S. delegates, it would have passed to become a gay-friendly denomination as of 2 days ago. But we have a learning curve, and the context and history of Africa is different, and so we have our work cut out for us, and... I ask that people who are prayerful to keep us in prayer.
Absolutely. Well, that's a revelation in itself. God's not done with us yet. If we could only just hold on to that.
I think we're not even close to done. We're barely in the oven. You know, when you think about all of the change that's happened on our world in the last 100 years, and how quickly things have begun to percolate and expand, and how much more knowledge we have now than we had even 100 years ago. But when we think about how much more we have as a civilization than we had 2,000 years ago, it's pretty significant. And I think that the rate of growth, the rate of change since Jesus has been here has been pretty phenomenal when you look back even further to, let's say, the last 50,000 years. So I think that, you know, many of the values and beliefs that existed at the time of Jesus's sojourn here, and the ideas about civilization that existed in his culture, the culture in which he lived and traveled and learned about humanity. Think about how many limitations he had on what he could talk about. You know, they're just... If his mission was to keep his teaching focused on the highest concepts of spirituality and uplifting the God concept to the highest level that he could, given the limitations of his cultural milieu, what did he have to limit himself to talking about? What kinds of people stories or parables or examples could he give to his apostles or to his disciples and followers? It had to fit in his day and age to the best of his ability. I imagine what he would be talking about if he were in this conversation with us now.
Yes. That delights the imagination.
Pardon me?
I said that delights my imagination.
and it could be that if Jesus hadn't incarnated at that time so long ago, 2,000 years ago, if it had happened now, it could be the case that God would have been more able to incarnate as a woman. In that context, it wouldn't have worked. It wouldn't have been listened to. She wouldn't have had a standing or a voice. But so that's part of why Jesus needed to be male in that time, in that culture. But in that role also was very egalitarian and radical. and stretched them to the extent that he could. But I think if Jesus were to come back again, not necessarily in male form this time, I don't think so.
Well, and who knows what culture, what race, what group he might have, been born into. Who knows what? Well, then I could also say, I wonder if he came back today as in his second coming, and had the same message that he had then. If which group would it be, or which group would it have been, who had it out for him? Who felt so threatened by him that they would want to see him put to death or, eliminated from the thought stream. In some ways, it might have been the fundamentalist Christians, because his message was always inclusive. Who did he come to preach to? He said, he was coming to give the good news to the weak and the fallen, to the sinners and the publicans, and the people who were at that time the most outcast in the Jewish culture that he was living in.
I think Christians of every generation should be considering that very question, and even to some extent thinking of, well, maybe not just the fundamentalist, maybe more moderate folks could find ourselves in the wrong perspective when push comes to shove, in that whole, which Jesus, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus of Nazareth, do we want Pontius Pilate to release to be free, and which one do we want to have crucified? It could be that some of us more moderate types might end up on the wrong side, and it's important for us to ponder these things. And I have thought of actually creating an emblem, commissioning a jeweler to make a pendant of a visual image of a lethal injection gurney, because if Jesus were to be around today and be executed today, it would be by lethal injection by the state. And a lethal injection gurney looks similar to a cross in a certain way, I think it keeps the following of Jesus a bit more radical, because the cross is so quaint and so far removed as a execution device that it's just a piece of jewelry for people. But following the way is scary business and dangerous, risky business at times. And so maybe it might be helpful to have something contemporary like the lethal injection gurney around our necks instead of the cross.
Wow. That's really interesting. That's really interesting, because although it wouldn't be nearly as torturous, as a death on the cross, it would be like you say, a more contemporary image of that public execution.
Yeah.
Well, and it's thought-provoking. I know an artist right now who does thought-provoking Christian art. His name is Steve Sawyer. His site is Art for God, just A-R-T, the letter for God, .com. And he shows Jesus in the boxing ring, with the gloves, the really masculine. He shows Jesus, rolling up his sleeves with a tattoo of Dad on his arm. So he kind of creates that paradigm shift where, you're thinking about Jesus in one way and all of a sudden you see him in another way. And I can just see him painting that picture you just described of Jesus strapped to the injection, gurney.
Go ahead. Sorry, didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, no, just because it would really make you think, oh, my gosh, if he was here today, perhaps that's where he'd end up. And we have to say to ourselves, why did he end up there? Because he ran athwart of the religious authorities, the ecclesiastical authorities. And it's always the authorities of some sort or another. They have the most to lose when someone comes along saying something that liberates people and empowers them to live courageous
yes.
lives before God. In other words, he told them, you don't need a middleman. You are, by faith, a child of God. And he was liberating them. When he turned over those tables in the temple, that was the last straw for the religious authorities. And, I mean, he ran directly athwart of their authority when he did that. And not only did it hit them in their ego, it hit them in their pocketbook. It was a double whammy.
Mm-hmm.
And that was it, you know. But he did it. He knew that they would seek to kill him because he knew they couldn't bear to face their own hypocrisy.
Yeah.
And that's painful. And it would be better to just not to go in denial again and not have to look at it. But he came with a powerful truth. And the world has never been fond of the truth. Let's face it. And there aren't that many leaders on earth. And so I think Jesus recognized that a lot of people are followers. They're sheep. He called them his lambs. You know, it's like he said to his apostles, if you love me, you'll feed my lambs. So he was recognizing that people are looking for an authority to lead them. But then he gave us that great saying, you know, about the blind leading the blind. And he actually tells us that he realizes that there are blind leaders. And there are. We know that. We've seen it over and over and over again in
the
history of humanity.
Well, and, you know, some of the most passionate people are blind in some way or another. In that, I think we have a very strong experience wherever we come from or whatever our tradition or culture is. We have an idea of or we have a memory of our personal epiphany. And
mm-hmm.
we really expect others to have the same one. And if it isn't the same, then we question its authenticity. And so often I think some of the most passionate leaders are people who really, truly, wholeheartedly have devoted themselves to their dogma or their belief about their experience rather than the essence of the experience itself. And which is, I think, almost universally that they are being given God's approval or God's love or God's acceptance for their either their life's work or their identity. And
yes.
I wanted to also mention, to go back to what you were talking about, Paula, with regards to Stephen Sawyer, the artist, and his work and his depictions of Jesus. And he actually has a painting that he's done that reminds me a little bit of the gurney concept. It's an image of a drug addict.
Mm-hmm. I was just going to say.
With a rubber tourniquet in his mouth and tattoos on his arms. And Jesus is leaning over him, one hand on one shoulder, leaning over, and he's put his arm where the man's arm would be, and so the guy is shooting up into Jesus' arm.
Yeah.
Very, very powerful image. That's a great example, Crystalline, of the kind of art he does. And I think we do need new symbols to help us understand, you know, the nuances of what it is we actually believe. And would it stand, I so appreciate, Roger, what you said, because it's an honest reflection to say to yourself, if you were here now, how would I line up?
Yeah.
You know, that is just really an honest question to ask. How would I line up? If he was saying something that is against the established norm, And if I stood to get kicked out of my church, like those apostles got kicked out of their synagogues, they were not welcome in their synagogues anymore. And those early believers of Jesus, they were considered to be beside themselves, you know, just as he was.
Yeah.
And yet they had the courage of their convictions to say, and I love to look at this analogy and say, okay, but, you know, because God is not done with us yet. I couldn't agree with you more. And God is still talking to us. And God reveals truth to us in every way that we are open to receiving it, is my feeling. And, you know, if we can take ourselves back to the day that he was here and realize that he grew up in a little village that was not necessarily held in high regard by the other environs, you know, in those environs, and certainly Jerusalem didn't think much of Nazareth, and he grew up in this village.
No good thing can come out of Nazareth.
Yeah, that was a saying. That was a common saying. And he grew up with these people, and they knew him.
Actually because the church, or not the church, but the synagogue there and the teachings there were considered really liberal compared to, like, the Jerusalem sect.
That's a good point. Kind of like Boulder. A mecca of creative thinking, you know, or kind of pushing the boundary. But that's what it would take. And, you know, you think about, okay, if I knew him and I grew up with him and I saw him as a boy and I went to school with him and I saw him interact with the Hassan and I saw his parents and siblings and whomever else. And then suddenly he made this claim to be the Son of God. What would I think? Would I think he was crazy? Or would I stop for a moment to listen to what he was saying, what the truth in his words, and judge based on that?
Mm. Yes.
That's an intriguing question to ask yourself, I think, because we are so quick to judgment.
I also think, too, that, you know, like as kids, and I don't know what kinds of stories around Jesus you had as a kid, but I remember the stories about Jesus when we were children were so beautiful. They were really quite lovely and quite compelling for little kids. You know, I don't remember having a lot of emphasis on the blood and the cross and the lamb aspect of Jesus when I was a kid. And maybe that's different if you're in a less mainline or less progressive Christianity upbringing, but it was definitely a really positive view of Jesus and one that you could really relate to as a little kid. But as we get older, the images about Jesus and the stories about him become much more difficult and not always so pretty. And the discussion or the debate becomes much more heated. And but what was it about the Jesus who talked to children that we seem to lose as we get older?
Yeah, why do we lose his humanity? In fact, sometimes we lose him. And I'd like to hear your point of view on this, Roger. I remember back in 1996 searching the internet for Jesus and finding only the church. And longing to see his teachings, longing to find him. And it was very difficult, and it kind of is symbolic of how something has taken its place, you know? But it's not that he's lost, he's still there.
Yeah, I think it's a complicated thing to answer, but One piece of it is that conservative Christianity tends to focus on the Gospel of John, and not that John's a bad gospel, But if one reads John's Gospel literally, it's the furthest away from the actual life of Jesus, written well after the others, to a very different kind of audience. And if you take that esoteric poetic language literally, the understanding of Jesus shifts, and it focuses less on his teachings and his way, and much more about, oh, he died on the cross so that we are saved from our sins. And that becomes the religion about him rather than of him. And we get focused and deluded on certain truth claims. You believe X, Y, and Z so that you will go to heaven later. And that's not the stuff that kids resonate with. The little children, they sense the loving kindness, the presence, the compassion, the grace, and the way of
the fruit.
You know, and kids were, you know, property. They were the lowest point on the totem pole, and that this traveling itinerant rabbi would deign to hang out with them under a tree was a bit radical, and yet that's how God's love is. And so I guess my answer is that in part it's sort of John's Gospel, in part it might be some of Paul's teachings or some of the letters attributed to Paul. Not that I want to beat up on that too much, because there's a lot of grace and love and truth in those letters, but there is a shift away from the way to intellectual truth claims. And when that happens, it becomes divisive, and we can miss the forest for the trees.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. There was something else we were talking about a few minutes ago that about the, you know, like, what would Jesus sort of say to us personally, or what would his message be for us individually today? What came to mind for me when you were talking about John, actually, I'm wrong. It would have been more experience with Peter. But I was just thinking about, you know, the kinds of things that Jesus spoke to individual apostles that were kind of warnings or not criticism so much as, you know,
admonitions.
There we go.
Yeah.
You know, like the one he gave to Peter about, you know, don't be so quick to judge your fellows. You yourself are going to deny me, you know, three times before the cock crows. Or the things he says to individual apostles to get them to be more considerate of each other and to be more forgiving of the people around them. And I wonder about what, when you were saying that, you know, even for progressive or more positive-minded Christians, how we may be on the wrong track and assuming that we're right. I often wonder about what kinds of things he would tell me, what sorts of traits or admonitions might he give to me to help me be more on the right path. And sometimes I feel like they are more sort of conservative admonitions. Like for me to be more loyal, or to be more devout, or to be less certain of my own opinions. It just, I don't know if this resonates with either of you, but yesterday I had a particularly rough day spiritually. I was finding myself feeling really upset, really angry, and incredibly impatient. And I was with spending some time with someone who was being very impatient. And I was getting very impatient with his impatience. And the more frustrated I got with how impatient he was, the more impatient I became. And I got a note from a group that called itself Patience. It was a Facebook, blurb. And I found myself taking it really personally. Like, were you a fly on the wall in my life today? Or, who called you and told you what I did today? Why is somebody sending me a message about patience? And I started laughing about how defensive I got about just getting this Facebook blurb on patience, thinking of myself as sort of being this very easygoing, laid back, someone who doesn't sort of jump to anger. And looking at, the way I behaved yesterday, I realized, oh my God, I'm so not done yet. I'm so half baked.
I'm so half baked. Well, Roger, we have a question for you from the board, and this is from a person who is also a retired minister. He was in the Unity Church for many, many years. He said, "I'm interested in your perspective of the shift away from Paul back to the search for the historic Jesus."
Well, so like the Jesus Seminar, that kind of project, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I have mixed thoughts. I have some varied thoughts. One is that there's great value in many of the projects that have been taken. In particular, the strand that resonates most with me is looking at the radicalness of this subversive Jesus and his anti-imperial teachings. And for instance, the scholarship that points out, I think of two things that come to mind. His primary teaching was of the kingdom of God. And in the Greek, it's basileia, which is better translated actually as the empire of God rather than the kingdom of God. So it's even bolder and more, in some respects, political and subversive. And so kingdom is in a way toning it down from the original empire of God perspective. And so it shows how Jesus' way was countercultural and subversive to the worldly Roman dominant power that was. And I also think of the scholarship, I think of Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg in their book, The Last Week, where it points out how Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem riding on the back of a donkey was on the same day that Pontius Pilate would have been entering that town from another gate on the other side of town because of the festivals, and whenever there's festivals, there's a risk for violence and tension, and so there's always a show of Roman force that, hey, don't rise up because we're large and in charge. And so Jesus is doing this counter process into town with his followers, and it's sort of a two fists coming together for an ultimate connection. And so that kind of scholarship that points out the radicalness and the subversiveness, I find liberating and invigorating and enlivening to the faith. But that said, some of the scholarship is from a liberal mindset, and progressive Christianity is more of a postmodern, post-liberal mindset. And so a liberal Christianity might be in the mindset of modernity, where there is objective truth and it can be discerned scientifically, and so the kind of work that, okay, well, how did Jesus walk on the water, and it could have been this scientific phenomenal process that could have been at play, or how did Moses part the sea, and was, well, there was this wind that parted the seas, and there's this weather pattern that's known to have happened. And I mean, that kind of work is missing the point. And so progressive Christianities tend to have a more of a narrative theology where we accept the received text and see the story and don't try to, you know, get too scientific with the text and just receive it as a story. And there's truth there for us, and rather than overly analyzing it. So on the one hand, I think it's life-giving and enlivening and re-radicalizing the faith, but parts of it can be, I think, a little wayward. So those are my thoughts, I guess.
Well, you know, and I love that, because sometimes it could be something very simple, too, like Peter had a visionary dream. And
right.
It was so powerful that he believed it. He saw Christ walking on water, or he saw him calm the waves, and that was it. It was so real to him that it became real to everybody else. Or Jesus on the cross reciting the psalm, my God, why have you forsaken me? Nothing more than that, just as he died, reciting scripture because he knew it so well. And to, as a way to take his mind off of the agony he was in, and yet now scholars for centuries have wondered, what was he saying? You know, did he really think God had forsaken him? No, of course not. And it could be something that simple, but we just don't think of that. You know, we go to the most complicated place, oftentimes do. You know. But
yeah.
I think the search for the historic Jesus, I mean, if you just look at Jesus at face value, and I've often recited on the air a saying that I love dearly about Jesus, written by a Christian, obviously, who, you know, is so in love with Jesus, too. And he just talks about, you know, on the face value, here is this man, you know, this preacher, itinerant preacher, he calls him, who, you know, never had a degree, wasn't celebrated in the way the world celebrates anybody. Just a simple man from Nazareth, a carpenter. Mm. And yet, no army that's ever marched, no parliament that's ever sat, no king that ever reigned will affect this world as much as that one solitary life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you just look at it from that point of view, you go, my gosh, what is it about this person that forever changed us? We date our calendars to him. It's like time began with him. What are we recognizing unconsciously that we don't recognize consciously? You know, we dissect him and try to find out, you know, figure out who he was. And that's great, you know, but on its face value, if ever there was an ambassador from the heavenly realm, it was him.
Mm.
And, you know, that's just intriguing to me. But I loved, you know, for instance, did Jesus have siblings? You know, some people who read the Bible think that he did. And now they found this estuary that says, you know, Andrew the Lord's brother or something. I can't remember now exactly what it said, but they're thinking, wow, an ancient, you know, artifact that has, you know, this idea that Jesus had siblings.
Yeah.
And
there certainly is a wide range. The Catholics, of course, believe Mary was perpetually a virgin, and so therefore Jesus had no siblings. But many of us would look at the book of James and
right, I was saying that, thinking that too.
Yeah, James probably was Jesus' brother, and some have speculated that Thomas, that the twin, may have been a brother of Jesus. I don't know that's a little bit speculative for me, but it's possible. And to a large extent, I mean, those kinds of things don't make or break my faith. I those are non-essentials. I mean, they're interesting, and it probably gives James a little bit more clout for me because, Jesus' brother probably got this in some ways that others might not have. But whether Jesus was born of a literal virgin or not, I mean, I there's lots of scholarship that would suggest that that may not be the case, and but it certainly could be the case. And for me, God can be glorified in either way. If Jesus was born of a virgin birth, well, that speaks to God's amazing power and the specialness of Jesus. If Jesus was born to as a bastard to a poor peasant in the eastern fringes of the Roman Empire, and from that humble beginning became the one to overthrow ultimately the Roman Empire, well, that's pretty powerful too. So I find good news. And
God reincarnated as man is, there's sort of, it's no less miraculous. You know, however it came to be, it's something that's beyond our comprehension.
Yeah.
It is. It is truly a miracle. I mean, when you think of it, the fact that, you know, and I've come to look at it this way, God touches us where we live. And when I went to Israel in 1994, we had the most amazing Arab Christian guy. This guy was extraordinary. And he would say things like, you know, theologians believe this and commonly believe that, but I think, you know. And we would just like so totally laugh when he'd say that, because he took himself so seriously. And yet he in his own right was a true theologian. Absolutely loved this guy. His name was Anis. And he took us up on the mountain one day where Jesus told us, you know, up on Mount Hermon. And Jesus had this talk with his apostles about who do men say that I am. And to get there, we had to go through where the headwaters of the Jordan, Caesarea Philippi, and it's a Roman city, and it's a beautiful place. And along this wall, there's these niches carved out. There's no statues of Roman gods in them anymore, but Anis explained to us that one time there was. At one time, there were statues of the Roman gods. And then Jesus went through Caesarea Philippi, and they went up on the mountain, and they sat together, and Jesus said, "Who do men say that I am?" And the apostles said, "Some men say, you know, you're a prophet. Some men say you're beside yourself, you know." And Jesus said, "But who do you say that I am?" And Peter said, "You're the Son of the living God." And Anis told us, "You see, I believe that Jesus brought his apostles through this place so they could see the difference between the dead gods of stone and the living God."
Mm.
That reaches men and women where they are, as they are, in a very real way. And we all had that same response. It was like, oh, wow, that is so beautiful. You know, we heard the truth of that.
Mm.
Well, and it makes so much sense, because Jesus had to talk so much in metaphors to get his message across. And you think about how challenging it was for them to overcome their nationalistic expectations of the Messiah, and how challenging it was for him to try to get them to understand the concept that he was there to reveal God to mankind, not just to the Jewish people. And just imagine how challenging that would have been for them, because they had so much history and such strong politics to overcome. We think religion and politics are drawn together now. Imagine how much more that was the case then.
Oh, that's a good point. Religion was politics back then. You know.
And for many, many, many centuries after that, even millennia.
Right up until the 20th century, probably.
Well, really, it was until the American Constitution and
that
the French Revolution.
Yeah.
Right. So it just was the way things were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the kings. the kings were the head of the church, and they were considered divinely ordained to rule. So politics and religion were very closely aligned. But anyway,
so, you know,
I digress.
Well, here we are with this job to hold up, you know. The man, behold the man. And I think that one thing I cherish so much is, you know, we've made him out. I love your comment about, you know, he would be no less amazing and miraculous had he been the illegitimate son of a poor peasant woman.
Right, right.
And it goes back to the reality of the human condition, and maybe what Jesus was doing was twofold. Maybe he was revealing God to man and also revealing man to God. And that's how he becomes the bridge between time and eternity. That's how he becomes the way, you know, the light, the truth, and the way, is because he bridged the gap between God and man and made it forever possible. You know, I have a friend who says, Jesus makes the hand of God small enough to grasp.
Beautiful.
I know. I just love that. Because for me, that is so true. You know, that's the God I know. That's my experience, my religious experience of knowing the God of love, the God of flowers, the Heavenly Father, because I had such a wonderful father. My concept of fatherhood is so healthy and so kind and loving and strong and upholding and protecting. It's really hard for me to think of God as offended and a punisher. You know what I mean? I can easily believe that God the Father transcends God the Judge. I know God is justice. But his mercy, any loving parent would understand that mercy eclipses justice. Mercy becomes about salvation and the lesson the child needs to learn, and not just about seeing that they're adequately punished. And, you know, so oftentimes we fall into that trap, I think, as religionists, and which is partly why, you know, as we progress in this world, in an age of science and enlightenment, that those old stories aren't working anymore. And I think most, you know, we've had other guests on who have talked, you know, who are very much like you, progressive like you, Roger. And, you know, they say that, you know, young people are rejecting the old stories. They're not accepting them anymore. Do you find that's true?
I'm going to say yes, but it's mixed. For instance, It is the case that the majority of growth in Christian churches in the U.S. is among more conservative evangelical churches. That's true. Now, are they drawing those people because they believe everything that's being taught, or is it because they do a lot of very intentional youth outreach, young adult outreach? They really have great musicians and great entertainment and music, and somehow they've created an ethos where young people feel comfortable being around other young people, and they sort of put up with what's being said. Now, my bias is sort of coming out there. I think there are still very valiant efforts to try to continue the modernist, evangelical, conservative approach. And some of those churches are growing, but within the evangelical world, there's, you know, progressive Christianity is a movement that comes out of the mainline church, but a similar phenomenon is happening in the evangelical world called emerging Christianity or emergent church, emergent Christianity, and folks like Shane Claiborne and Doug Padgett and Brian McLaren. And many others are rethinking and reprioritizing what they think are the core teachings. Is it abortion and gay and homosexuality, or is it more the environment and poverty? And there's a shifting going on, a realignment of what matters and what's less of a priority. So there's movement there too. So I think there are still plenty of folks trying to tell the old story in the same old ways, and there's some apparent statistical success with it, but there's also a lot of creative novelty and what I think is a reformation to a truer, more authentic way of doing the church and being a follower of Jesus happening as well.
That's exciting.
Shane Claiborne at the Christianity 21, actually the same place I met you. We were joking before the show started that you and I have met before, but I only saw the back of your head and you only saw my feet because I was standing next to you while you were getting a massage at the Christianity 21 conference in Minneapolis.
That's right.
But I met Shane
and
Doug and several of the other leaders in that movement at that event, and just how impressive it was to actually have some of the women pastors and ministers in that movement. And it was very interesting to me to find out how sort of disenfranchised women had been coming from that conservative or evangelical Christian tradition. And whereas that had never been my experience growing up, because we had women pastors, and I grew up in the UCC church, but my parents were medical missionaries in Ghana, so our experience of the Christian church in the 60s in West Africa was not nearly as sectarian. We had a lot more unity and where all the different churches worshipped and worked together.
Ecumenical spirit.
Ecumenical, yeah. It was much more ecumenical there. And so it was interesting for me to be part of that event, because I really saw this incredible energy fomenting and building and growing within or coming out of what to me had been sort of the least expected place, you know, sort of a really conservative arm of Christianity, where in a way the constriction of that dogma had been so tight that the rebellion or the breaking the shell, breaking out of that shell, was so dynamic. And in a way it was more dynamic than what I was seeing happening in mainline and in more progressive Christianity, because they were sort of on fire with the spirit that of the evangelical movement carried, that in some ways seemed to have sort of, if not died out, was certainly a lot more mellow in the more progressive churches, my experience.
One of the speakers, I believe, yes, she was at the Christianity 21 event in Minneapolis, was Dr. Phyllis Tickle. And
yes, we've had her on this program, actually.
What I'm about to say, she's probably already said on your show, but she has done scholarship that suggests that every 500 years, the Christian church has entered a time of reformation. And wouldn't you know, we are at that point. And what seems to be going on is that the Spirit is afoot and at work, and the two fronts that seem to be happening are the progressive Christian front and the emerging Christian front from the two different traditions. There's also the charismatic piece, too, and all of it, I think, is Holy Spirit-led. And there seems to be we're in a mashup culture. You know, a lot of the music the young people are listening to is mashup. It's borrowing samples from earlier music and then they weave it into their own stuff. And
it's
sort of a world music mashing of different styles and genres, eras together. Well, that's indicative of the kind of work that I think is happening theologically. And I think we are in a ripe, juicy time. It's messy and frustrating, but it's certainly good, and God is muddying the waters and stirring the pot. And I think the mainliners are being enlivened by seeing evangelicals and charismatics doing what they do and sharing, and more evangelicals, wouldn't you know, all of a sudden are doing more spiritual practices, centering prayer, and they're doing Lent, and they're doing Advent, and they're doing the lectionary, and following litanies, and there's this mishmash of things. So it's not so easy to just say, well, Baptist churches are this way, or Methodist churches are this way, or independent churches are. There's this incredible diversity and messiness.
Lots of crossover.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
well, that's
what I
loved about. Go ahead, yeah. Roger.
Well, I just but you know about the Wild Goose Festival coming up?
Yeah, I was just
going
to say that's what I loved about the Wild Goose last year. When I was there, and what was so striking to me and startling to me was various groups of Christians, all different denominations, there for the same purpose, to have the conversation, to ask the tough questions, to be inspired. And their bookstore was such a, ministers of all different stripes, you know. I mean, Richard Rohr, I so thoroughly enjoyed reading his book, Falling Upwards. And I mean, a wonderful theologian, but just a truly wise man. And I loved his talk that he gave there. And, you know, to see his book on sale with Brian McLaren's books, with, you know, and there's just this whole host of people who are teaching, Christians who are teaching in this movement, and they're not from the same sect. It crosses all those boundaries, and that's what's so exciting to me. I mean, and certainly it was mostly people under 40, and they brought their kids, and you know, they felt like you could tell that there was something definitely happening there, and it's a culture of diversity and inclusion and acceptance. And you know, we've had Steve McIntosh on the show even not that long ago, and he talks a lot about integral philosophy, and that even is being embraced in this movement. It's very, very exciting to me. I'm going to the Wild Goose next month. I may go to all of them after. You'll be there?
Oh, that's great.
You'll
get a chance to meet each other, hopefully.
You're
going
to be speaking there.
Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Well, I won't miss that.
And we've had Doug Padgett on a couple of times on our show, and a couple of Steve McKnight and a couple of other folks from the emergent movement. And we've also had some people on from some fairly conservative organizations and religions and perspectives. And what we find is that we find common ground nowadays from all different sectors of believers. And what my own personal religious experience or spiritual perspective is that we have more in common with one another as believers than we have with those who are not believers. From every different faith, really, on the planet. And from my perspective, I think that is what Jesus meant by the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God, is that our perspective is altered once we become faith sons or faith children of the Universal Father. And that experience of identifying with spirit reality changes our view, changes our experience of the world. And if not limited by dogma, that experience is one of spiritual freedom.
Yeah.
Of being able to live in a place where heaven is accessible here and now by believing in a doctrine of faith and love and possibility and serving one, you know, serving your fellow man, we move out of this worldly experience and into an experience of what heaven is like. We move into a place where we can experience that deep sense of joy and happiness and satisfaction in life. And it's something that happens quite separately from a belief and quite profoundly having to do with a faith, a faith in better things. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. It's when people have the light bulb turned on. And the Hindus have a lovely word, upayana, which is the many ways, the many means. And the Christian version of that, I guess, is that the Lord works in mysterious ways. And the Hindus have a very generous perspective. I mean, any individual Hindu may not embrace this, but their overall teaching is that Christians are fellow Hindus. It's just their way of being Hindu. And so they don't do a whole lot of trying to convert Christians to become Hindus because they're already on a path. Be the best Christian you can be.
Right.
And so I think the perspective you're articulating is the same kind of generous spirit that by whatever name, the fact that we're seeking to be connected to and a part of something bigger than ourselves, something that's source is love, that we feel in our gut and in our heart and that we can express through our actions and our words. Well, when we come to a place of having that and sensing that, by whatever name, praise God. It's what it's all about.
It is, and that's
indeed.
And that's the greatest realization I think we could make. And, you know, I think of Jesus again saying, by their fruits you will know them. Another way to look at that for me is just him telling us, so get to know them. Because you can't know them in an instant. You can't sit down and have a quick conversation with somebody and write them off because they don't happen to believe the same way. In order to get to know a person's fruits, in order to know if they're loving or kind or generous or sincere or stalwart or trustworthy, you know, you can't determine that in an instant. You'd have to spend time with them. You'd have to see them in different situations. And so it doesn't matter. Go ahead.
Well, you're reminding me of an interesting airplane ride that I had just recently. I was a guest speaker at Glade United Church of Christ in Blacksburg, Virginia, a few weeks ago. And on my flight from Charlotte back to Denver, I sat next to a young woman who was a Jehovah's Witness. And she saw me working on revising my book, Kissing Fish, which I'm always up to revising it. And she was intrigued. And so she asked about progressive Christianity and what this is all about. And so I shared with her some basics about it. And she asked many, many questions. And I shared as much as I could. And then I asked about her inquisitiveness and where she's at in her journey, and she shared about herself. And it was a rather surreal experience where she was in no way trying to convert me or sell me onto her faith, and I wasn't in any way trying to convert her or sell her onto my approach. And it defied the stereotypes that I think sometimes we tend to have of each other. And it was beautiful. And she gave me a copy of Jehovah's Witness book that I was enjoying looking through, and I gave her a copy of Kissing Fish, and I was surprised that she received it, and she accepted it, and who knows what God's going to do with it. I don't know that I'm going to be converting to a Jehovah's Witness or that she's going to be converting to identify as a progressive Christian, but God was definitely there, and we shared enough of that almost three-hour journey together where, oh, there's definitely common ground, and there's more alike than different in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it would be so beneficial to all of us humans. And if we took the pressure of feeling like it's our job to save people, you know,
Or to convert them.
Yeah, but underlying that conversion thing is this idea that they aren't saved if they're not converted. And even within Christianity, different sects like the Jehovah's Witnesses believe that even other Christians aren't saved if they're
right.
not converted. And conversion is really not our job. Maybe our job is to inspire each other and love each other and sit and listen patiently and kindly and, like Jesus said, serve. He who will be greatest among you will be the one to serve the others. But salvation is God's job, and that happens in the inner life. And, that's something that we can't see or know, really. Where that person is in their inner life with their Creator. And unless we get to know them by their fruits and take the time to know them by their fruits, I think that all we can do is just assume the best about them, that God has them covered and He's given them whatever they need to get through. And
that the Most High's rule in the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men.
Right.
That,
the Most High's
you know,
rule
that
in
we're,
the kingdom.
We're really not in charge of running the universe. I find that comforting, personally, most of
yeah,
the time.
Yeah, me too.
Stress levels go down a lot when I think about that. It helps a lot.
We don't have to take on the burden of making sure that this person has eternal life. The Heavenly Father is going to do that. He's going to get them there if they're willing to go. In any way, shape, or form, He'll get them there. What we're called to do, I think, is comfort each other and help each other. And, if our Father could hug a human, He would. But He counts on us to do that for Him. If He could sit and listen and hold a hand and be a shoulder to cry on, He would. But He counts on us because He's in us. And so we're called to do His work. And on this level, we're His eyes, we're His ears, we're His hands. Somebody told me recently, it just struck me so hard. If you ask, a lot of people ask God, why do you allow this to happen? And then God's response is, why do you? You look around on the world and you say, I've had people come up to me, atheists, come up to me and say, your God lets people starve. And, he gives us all hearts and hands and minds and a willingness to serve and help. And if people are starving, it's because we're letting it happen. So I think that's a paradigm shift, too, that, we realize the work we're called to do. It's just help and love each other.
Well, and one of the inspirations for this series that we've been doing on the on Cosmic Citizen is, sharing personal spiritual experience, sharing your personal religious experience from different faith traditions, is to reinforce this concept that we have more in common than what separates us, and that this coming together and sharing our personal religious experience, our faith, our walk, is to expand our understanding of what it's like to be in someone else's shoes, and to avoid that overly self-righteous or
knee-jerk
circumspect, knee-jerk reaction to our own religious beliefs, ideas, and experience, to expand that, to expand our hearts and our minds by learning about what it's like to walk in someone else's faith path. And because it seems to me that Jesus was promoting that kind of intimacy with each other. That I think that was something that was really important to him. when you look at the way he... Go ahead.
Well, it's been said that Christianity is a relationship, and that's one of the essential bottom lines, that it's about relationship, and ultimately that's the way people grow and touch each other. Jesus had connections with people, real profound moments with real people, and in the relationship, in the exchange, in the encounters where transformation took place. And so the best sermons, I think, are ones where it's not a lecture where you're sharing facts. It's simply the parts where someone's sharing their story, their testimony, and so you are being invited to live into their experience, and you hear about someone else's moment, and you see yourself in it. That is where transformation takes place. It's in my own journey, I had some homophobia growing up, sort of enculturated, and it took a while to shed it. And it wasn't facts and figures that shifted me, although knowing about scholarship in the Bible and different understandings helped. But really it was through having housemates and knowing people and interactions where my own consciousness was raised and transformation took place. I forget which wise sage said this, but the best way to get rid of an enemy is to make them your friend. And that's your show is a big part of that. We are helping to reduce the sense of the other as being different or scary, and we're getting to know each other, and there's less to fear when we have shared laughs and shared stories and see common ground. It's less scary and therefore less threatening, and therefore the shift from enemy to friend happens. And I think God is at work in what you're doing. This radio show is a ministry, and God is at work.
Thank you.
Well, we believe really strongly in the concept of a cosmic citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And we're inspired by a speech or a sermon heard many years ago about what does it take to raise cosmic citizens? Like, rather than thinking about what does it take to raise a good American citizen or even a good world citizen, what are the elements that would be involved in raising a good cosmic citizen? It was one of the most inspiring speeches that I had heard in my life. And one of the things that the man who was giving the speech said was that home needs to be a place where children know that no matter what, they're always welcome. No matter what they do, no matter what happens in their life, home is a place where you will always be welcome to, you know, walk in the door.
Yes.
No matter what. And he went on to say that forgiveness is not for those who deserve it. If you deserved it, that would be justice.
I love that.
And that there was something about that, you know, shook my core and really, really turned a lot of my critical, judgmental natures around and caused me to question that really seriously, and looking at what would make us good cosmic citizens, in assuming that the eternal life was something that we could kind of take for granted, and that there was something more ahead of this, and that the whole universe had some critical import to me personally and to all of us. What would make us worthy to go out into the universe as evangelists or as ministers or as citizens? And, you know, I think of things like Star Trek and the Prime Directive, or Star Trek and their, you know, the way they interact with beings from other worlds and completely different species and completely different cultures and traditions. And I have a sense that that's something similar to what life after death is going to be like. I mean, for me, my image of it is very much like a voyage through the universe. I don't think of heaven as being something that is going to be sort of an instant experience, but an ongoing growth. I can't imagine that I'm going to wake up on the other side and be perfect suddenly. You know, have all of my human errors and deficiencies instantly, you know, eradicated. I think evolution is an ongoing process.
You're reminding me the piece about the motive for your show of not just what would make for a good American citizen or a good global citizen, but a good cosmic citizen. I'm reminded, strangely, of a interesting commonality that you share with a tendency of conservative evangelical churches, which is beautiful. One of their favorite passages, of course, we all know, is John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, right? And for them, that's, you know, the critical bottom line of the story and getting people to believe X, Y, and Z. But
the gospel,
word
in
the Greek, the for God so loved the world is actually for God so loved, and the Greek word is the cosmos,
mm-hmm.
which
right.
means not just literally terra firma, the earth. It means all that is the entire
right.
universe, all of the cosmos.
Right.
So, in some respects, you could say that you're following a John 3:16 mandate to do what you do. So, I just find that beautiful.
Well, that's funny. That was the very first Bible verse that I learned, and I was not yet 5 when I was called among 3 other children to stand up in the front of the church in our little village in Ghana on Easter Sunday and recite some Bible verses, and that was the one I was supposed to recite. And I've never had any problem speaking in front of large groups of people, even when I was a little kid. And I knew that inside and out, but I got up in front of the church, and I got total stage fright. And I completely forgot every single thing I was supposed to say, and I just stood there with my face turning bright red and said nothing. And you know, here I was supposed to be this missionary kid, you know, so I was sort of supposed to be, I mean, I wasn't a pastor's daughter, I was a doctor's daughter, but, you know, I was expected to at least be able to get up there and recite a Bible verse. I couldn't for the life of me get a word out. But I've never forgotten.
Never forgotten that passage. No way.
No.
Wait, you know, Roger, something you said just reminds me of a favorite quote from the Urantia book. And it's because you shared that, you know, you've overcome certain prejudices in life. And I think the way that we overcome those things is by being willing to look at them in an objective way. Or, you know, when we hear something that is counter, you know, another person's point of view, and they kind of hit the ball out of the park, you know, and you have to take that and look at it and say, you know, maybe they didn't choose to be this way. Maybe this is just the way they are, and they have to deal with it. And, you know, my being mad at them because they're the way they are is folly. But this is the quote that it reminds me of. It's from Paper 160. And it says, successful living is nothing more or less than the art of the mastery of dependable techniques for solving common problems. The first step in the solution of any problem is to locate the difficulty, to isolate the problem, and frankly to recognize its nature and gravity. The great mistake is that when life problems excite our profound fears, we refuse to recognize them. Likewise, when the acknowledgement of our difficulties entails the reduction of our long-cherished conceit, the admission of envy, or the abandonment of deep-seated prejudices, the average person prefers to cling to the old illusions of safety and to the long-cherished false feelings of security. Only a brave person is willing honestly to admit
and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.
Mm.
Isn't that beautiful?
Wow.
Powerful.
And so appropriate. I mean, it speaks to, you know, it really speaks to you because we all have those experiences.
Yeah. And that's a growing experience. That's growth. That's a good thing. We all have those human traits, those, you know, long-cherished, deep-seated prejudices or, you know, envy, conceit, whatever. Those are human traits that we have to overcome. We're not born perfect, and it's a long, hard road. When you look into a baby's eyes, they're such a clean slate. But you know that a lot, you know, those negative human traits will get in sooner or later. Because we all have to battle those things. But
yeah.
There's a way through, and that's with honesty. Sincere, you know, sincerely being willing to look at what you believe and what you think and question it and evaluate it.
We're getting very close to the end of the show. We're down to the last 4 minutes, and I wanted to ask you to, if you can, briefly talk about the work that you do on campus.
Sure. So anytime there's a state university in the U.S. and there's a United Methodist-sponsored campus ministry, it's almost always called the Wesley Foundation or Wesley Fellowship, something like that. And I'm the director of the Wesley Foundation at the University of Colorado in Boulder. I work primarily with undergraduate and graduate students at CU, but increasingly some from Naropa University, which is a Buddhist-oriented school down the street, and several other community colleges and schools nearby as well. We have a very unique approach to our ministry. So there are 28 campus ministries at CU. We are one of the oldest, going back to 1917, and as of 5 years ago, we are a reconciling congregation, meaning that we are overtly LGBTQ-friendly and are very welcoming of folks of different persuasions and backgrounds. We emphasize a progressive way of being Christian. We don't have any expectation that people become Methodists at all, but probably half the students who are active maybe have that background, but by no means is it the majority. And during the course of a week, we offer a lot of things that stem from our understanding of salvation, being physical, mental, spiritual, for the whole person. And so we have free yoga classes on Monday nights, and not from an Americanized exercise yoga perspective, but from a spiritual being yogis off the mat and living our lives with more ease and grace and letting go of samskara that's not serving us, a real deep perspective.
Beautiful.
And we have had dance lessons on Tuesday nights, and Wednesdays we have centering prayer, which is effectively Christian meditation, quality time with God. And we have community meal on Wednesday at noon, and at night we have our gospel choir, Mosaic Gospel Choir, which is an interfaith gospel choir. We sing Christian gospel music, but maybe a third of the folks are Christian, and a third maybe are Buddhist, and maybe a third are sort of New Agey or neo-pagan or unidentified. And what brings us together is a love of singing and a love of gospel music, and we have a great time doing that. And Thursday we have Bible study. Saturday we often have community service projects where we primarily make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for the area homeless folks and serve them out where they are. And Sunday night we worship. And every spring break we do an alternative spring break work trip. And this year we went to Haiti and dug a foundation for a duplex. And
wow.
Did a lot of hard work. And so I have the privilege of journeying with people. Sometimes it's just for a semester. Sometimes it's for all 4 or more years of their journey here at the university. And I try to empower student leaders in different ways and help nurture the future of the church, and help model a progressive approach to the whole thing that, as I said at the beginning of the show, is arguably a very conservative approach because it's emphasizing the original values of compassion,
mm-hmm.
love, grace, mercy,
mm-hmm.
forgiveness, justice. And a lot of the campus ministries don't quite know what to make of us because we don't fit in their box of what Christian ministry is, but we're boldly pressing forward doing our thing. And,
boldly going where no man gone before.
Yeah, and boy, you are busy. I thought I was busy, Roger. You've got a lot going on. Wonderful ministry.
The spring semester is about to come to an end, and my workload decreases over the summer, so I'll be able to catch my breath and recharge for fall.
Bravo. Thank you for your ministry. Thank you
very much.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being on with us. We really are grateful to you taking the time.
Absolutely. It's a delight. And I can't wait to meet you, Roger, at the Wild Goose Festival coming up.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing you.
Yeah, I'll make it a point.
Well, God bless you. And
bless you also.
Yeah.
Thanks again, and we hope to have you on again sometime in the future.
Yeah. Be fantastic.
Thank you so much.
Thank
All right,
you.
Well, be
Thanks
well,
for
everybody.
Spending your Saturday with us.
All right. Bye for now.
Every blessing. Bye for
Bye-bye.
Now.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book, so all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.